Welcome back to the Cracking Backs podcast. Today we journey into the intricate world of cranial function with Dr. John Laurence. From the revolutionary technique of functional cranial release that shaped his clinical journey to the intriguing realms of cranial morphology and rhythm and their impact on our brains. Dive deep with us into the vibrant world of methylene blue, an ally to hemoglobin and its transformative potential for health, especially when stacked. Discover the mysteries of the brain's blue spot and hold tight as we challenge widely accepted beliefs on melatonin. Are we basing our knowledge on nocturnal rats or groundbreaking research? Dr. Laurence breaks it all down. Strap in. This is a conversation you won't want to miss. Dr. John Laurence, I'll tell you, after reading about you, I have been thoroughly, it's piqued my interest, and I can't wait to talk to you about a whole host of things that you do that most chiropractors don't, and I have an affinity for functional neurology and medicine, and I can't wait to talk to you about it. Thank you. Thank you for being on the show, buddy.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome. I do remember us running into each other at one or two Carrick events. Yes.
Oh, my gosh, that's right. That's right. The mild traumatic brain injury program. So Dr. Bagnell is one of my best friends. So, you know, we've had him on the show and he thinks highly of you too. So that's great, yeah, man. Awesome. So let me jump in and start, have you tell our listeners about your journey in the world of chiropractic neurology and functional medicine. I love that stuff. What inspired you to pursue this unique path?
You know, it's been interesting. Like I was talking to a patient earlier. We're having an event tomorrow, actually. And I have some people that have flown in from out of town that have wellness clinics. And they were asking me a little bit about that as well. And just reflecting on my 30-year career and looking at all of the different lives I've lived, you know, and initially, probably like most chiropractors, you know, I got out of school and I was just 100% straight chiropractic. I mean, I just, you know, I believed that you set the bone and let the body do its thing. And that probably worked one day. You know, when you talk to your old time chiropractors, they said, hey, back in the day, you know, you fixed their subluxations, you corrected their spinal misalignments, you free those nerves up, let the innate do the rest. But these days, there's too many headwinds. And I look at it as headwinds to basically stressors they compound. And all stressors have one thing in common, and that is that they create inflammation in the body, right? So we have to adapt to stresses. And in order to adapt to stresses, we can adapt to a level, but then when it exceeds our ability to adapt, then that's when you start to spill into this cytokine effect where inflammation ensues. And inflammation can be really good. In fact, we do a lot of procedures in our practice that activate inflammation. Massage and washa is a very aggressive form of like removing scar tissue. And there's a lot of inflammation associated with that treatment. Prolotherapy, you know, there's a number of like regenerative treatments that we utilize. Our practice is we have various types of physicians. And so we're medical and chiropractic and alternative, but we do platelet rich plasma from people's blood and we'll inject that. And that becomes very inflamed for a day or two. But inflammation can be a friend and it can be a foe. Chronic inflammation is not something that is suitable for having a healthy, happy, long, prosperous life. And so toxins in our environment, different types of microbes, those are the two primary headwinds that I see that create inflammation. And when that inflammation exceeds our ability to adapt, which it has in my life many times. I know, Spencer, you had asked me a question, and I'm kind of getting into some of probably the meat of what we're going to be talking about this today. But
love it.
But I got so sick, and I had a practice that was probably what every chiropractor would want. I had people from flying in from all over the world. I had a 10,000 square foot building right next to the hospital, the gym. I had three acupuncturists working for me. I had nutrition, dietitians. I mean, it was a big deal. And then I got really sick and I couldn't fix myself. I didn't know what was wrong. And I went from weighing almost 200 pounds and I'm 5'10 and a half. And at the time I had no body fat. So I was really in great shape, kite surfing and doing all kinds of extreme sports. And then within a few months, I was like down to 140. Cool. And I was emaciated. And people thought I was addicted to drugs because I felt really angry. I was very irritable because the inflammation just was like, it was just eating me up, right? And I couldn't find out what was wrong with me. I was going to a lot of my holistic friends and colleagues, and they were testing me. But most of it was like functional testing. I didn't need at that point, I needed like some legit medical deep, like, what is really going on with this guy, right? And it turned out that after years of searching, I finally tested myself for Lyme, and Lyme showed up. And then after that, I tested myself for a number of viral infections, and I had just almost any infection I tested myself for, there it was. And, you know, ultimately that road lasted for a long time, and I was trying to treat for my Lyme disease, and I was trying to treat for the Epstein-Barr, and I was getting better, but I just wasn't able to like get over the hump. And then I finally found out I just was living in a very moldy house.
Mm. Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. And so then the biotoxin illness picture started to make itself very clear. And I really think it's all that clinical picture of biotoxin illness was such an insightful light for me to, number one, change my practice and start in a different direction on how I was going to deal with patients, and begin to treat even much more complicated patients than I was before, because it gave me the ability to treat disease at the most core aspect possible, the most upstream. And we can talk about that in some very actionable, easy steps for people listening to this to take. And the other thing is it inspired me to, because I had a company where I was making some suppositories and some nasal sprays and what I would call more like, not supplements, but healthcare technology. And it spurred me to basically just expand. And we created a company called MitoZen, MitoZen, which is a membership based company where we do education. We make a bunch of different delivery systems and products that really target, I would say, biotoxin, metabolic disease, but also we do a lot with like kind of spiritual and plant medicine and kind of ceremonial things with that, because I believe that mind, body, spirit, right? And so the three pillars in my world for fully caring for my patients are identity, divinity, and vitality.
Oh, that's cool.
Love that.
And so if you break that down, you know, we have to have a vital, our physical body, the more vital it is, the better the brain, the more we can comprehend and the more conscious we can become, the better that we can treat other people, the happier we are, the more contribution we can make to our society and those around us. Identity is this relationship with ego and this relationship with our mission in life and our purpose. And divinity is a direct experience of God or the divine or the quantum or Allah, you know, whatever that word is for you. And you put all of these things together and you can have some real magic.
Oh, I love it. So you went through quite a bit before you found a recipe that seemed to help you that could be a recipe for many others. Is that what what you went through to before you found out?
I like to call it pain to purpose.
Pain to
I like that.
I like that. Very philosophical too. Where does the functional cranial release, which I find fascinating, fit into all this?
Well, so within my first year as a chiropractor, so I grew up in Hawaii. I think we talked about that before we hit record. My father was in the military. We moved out to Hawaii when I was 5, and I never even left the island until I was 15. So I was like totally fully indoctrinated into the Aloha spirit in Hawaii. And growing up and going to high school in Hawaii as a decent looking haole, the local girls would obviously be like, "Hey, how you doing? You want a date?" And they might or might not have broken up with the local boy that they were going out with. And so sometimes you would be finding yourself late at night at a park and, you know, you would have to defend yourself. So anyway, I got my nose broken one night. And ever since then, I couldn't breathe through the right side. And so when I went to Parker in Dallas. Yeah. And I remember somewhere in the middle of school, somebody was having a conversation about this balloon technique where a balloon was inserted in the nose and it expanded it. And it like was just a light bulb for me. I'm like, I need that. And I asked them, "Do you know somebody?" I just immediately was like, I got to find somebody to do that. And so it's almost a year and a half later, I'm in Miami, right? And I believe that's your neck of the woods. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to be there next week, by the way. We got to connect.
Okay. Let's do it. That'd be great.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the Centners out there in Miami? Layla and David Centner, they have the Centner Academy.
Yes. I am somewhat familiar. I used to treat somebody with that last name too, so I'm not sure, but we'll talk more about it. I'm more in the Fort Lauderdale area now too. So we'll definitely catch up on that. Interesting.
I was in Fort Lauderdale at a seminar, and there was a guy, Lou Arendt, and I think Lou Arendt right now is he's dealing with some health issues. I think he might have either retired or semi-retired. Do you know Lou?
A friend of mine. Yes, that is a friend of mine, but I haven't spoken to him in a couple of years.
You might want to reach out. He's, I need to myself, but you know, that happens. You know, I'm seeing that more and more people getting sick. And I think it's just it's a product of all of the stressors that we're talking about, you know, and you start to get into the 50s and 60s and there's a lot of things that are happening and a lot of losses that are occurring. So it just means we've got to start taking better care of ourselves earlier on. We don't wait until those crisis situations, right? And I really have some amazing things I want to talk about and try to stay on point with regards to that, because I think some of the most important aspects and low-lying fruit as far as us not getting sick, revolves around Ganesh, right? The Lord of Doorways. You guys seen the Hindu God with the elephant character?
Yeah.
Ganesh. Okay, so let's circle back and remind me about Ganesh.
I want you to tell about the nasal.
The balloons.
The balloon, because I've been hearing more about it. I'm talking about it more to people, but I want you to share your experience with that, please.
So do you see Ganesh over here?
Yeah.
Can you see he's got the balloon inflator in his hand?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You see that?
Yep.
So Lou was there. He was at this seminar and he did the treatment on me and it was just incredible. And so I went and learned the technique from the guy that taught him, and the guy that taught him learned it from the guy that kind of put it on the map. Wow. And so then after working with it for a while, I blended it in with a lot of the studies that I did with the Carrick Institute, because I felt that it really has a very profound impact on neurology, the vestibular system, the autonomics, the ability for cerebral spinal fluid to bring nutrients and bathe the brain and spinal cord. Just the things I have seen over the years, over my 30 years doing endonasal, has just been incredible. I wrote a book. You can find it on Amazon. It's called It's All in Your Head. And it's a very deep dive into a lot of aspects, ranging from this idea that our craniums are contracting, they're collapsing, and it's collapsing our nasal passages. And so, you know, even like a lot of our kids become mouth breathers, and we need to open this up. We need to get the oxygen in the nose and the nasal passage. And the nasal passage, when air flows through the nasal passage, especially higher areas of it, there's nerves up there that pace something called limbic oscillations or neuronal oscillations. And so these oscillations, I don't want to get too into the weeds. I do in the book, but these oscillations, if you think about, like, everything's a rhythm, right? We have a sun up and sun down, you know, we have tides, we have hormonal rhythms, we have respiratory rhythms, our digestion has a rhythm, our lymphatics, everything in our body has rhythms, right? And so these rhythms are very, very important. And our respiratory rhythm needs to be connected with our nervous system, because the nervous system needs to know, like, how do I need to be right now? How do I need to react? How do I need to prepare, right? And so if we have a fast respiratory rhythm, then that might be a signal to say we need to be more prepared for stress. If we have a slow respiratory rhythm, we may be more of an indication that we might want to be more in a resting and digest or a parasympathetic situation. But what if this is collapsed and that message isn't getting up there? Then we have some dysfunction that happens where these pacing signals don't occur properly. And that's what the science has really shown when it comes to mouth breathers, is that there's dysfunctional limbic oscillations and neuronal oscillations. And where that really causes most of the problem is in an area of the brain called the locus coeruleus. And in Latin, that means blue spot. And so the blue spot is something that I've been extremely interested in lately, and I've been studying it in great lengths and looking at the whole situation with this area of the brain and how this area of the brain can be made healthier, because I'm finding it to be possibly the most important area of the brain for us in this day and age. And the reason being is because it's the master control system for norepinephrine in the brain, similar to the adrenals being the core area for cortisol, right? So if we don't have the adrenals working properly, we all have, you know, I mean, I'm sure the three of us have all had adrenal exhaustion at some point, right? We've overdone it.
Yeah.
And you just can't get up in the morning, right? So it's necessary. We have to have the gas pedal for life. And so norepinephrine is that adrenaline in the brain. We don't have epinephrine's in the body. Norepinephrine is in the brain. And norepinephrine is what is, like I mentioned, it's kind of the gas pedal. And so the blue spot is master control system. So it has fingers, it has nerve connections to virtually all areas of the brain, and it's kind of controlling whether we're going to have norepinephrine go up or if it's going to go down. And it does that based on its pacing. What rate is it pacing per second? And it generally goes between 0.5 to 14 hertz. That's kind of the range. Respiratory rhythm is, you know, 2 to 14, something like that. And so when we look at the locus coeruleus and the health of the locus coeruleus, what that area of the brain controls is memory, especially short-term memory. It controls mood. It controls our what's called this, it's an area of our brain called the salient network, which is our ability to actually just focus our attention on something. So if we get into a situation where there's a danger response, where say something jumps out, and surprises us, we're going to be like super focused for a moment where we're like, oh my God, okay, is that friend or foe? Do I need to do something or do I need to act, right? It's this this immediacy, and the norepinephrine goes up, right? Our heart rate goes up and we have this salience where we're like really focused our attention on something. And so that's kind of the extreme of that locus coeruleus really getting activated. And it has connections to C2. So for chiropractors listening to this, you know, we're going to be wanting to look and saccade and turn our head to that threat. And so if we have a lot of problems with our C2, we're going to be having a lot of like upregulation to that locus coeruleus, which means, I mean, we're going to kind of get into this, but like, what does this really mean? This means that your ability to relax and be calm and centered and in the moment, right, where we all want to feel like that bliss and that comfort, this is a direct, in direct proportion to how slow we can slow that area of the brain down. And this is the problem with a lot of situations, is a lot of disease processes create this windup of the locus coeruleus and doesn't allow it to pause, right? So a complete pause would be either to one or below one. And if that doesn't happen at night, there's something really, really interesting that happens. And this is why it's so linked to depression and PTSD and anxiety disorders, is that the memory consolidation is a concept where we take our short-term memory that is stored in the locus coeruleus. So literally the locus coeruleus is like a little thumb drive. As we're going through our day, we're storing this information in the locus coeruleus. And at night, what it wants to do is that thumb drive wants to unload its data. So then it has fresh area and fresh space to accumulate more short-term memory for the next day, right? But what happens is it can't unless we have REM sleep. We have to have a deep REM sleep, low serotonin. We have to have high estrogen. Higher estrogen levels really matter with this. And also pain medications can really interfere with this pausing effect. So I did a whole schematic, and I can send it to you, where there's like a diagram and it looks at all of the different headwinds that affect and charge up the locus coeruleus. And then we talk about things, all the different things that you can do to take care of your locus coeruleus and calm it down. And what I found is that sleep is like incredibly important, and protecting your sleep so that you can fully pause that locus coeruleus, and we can take that short-term memory and we can convert it into long-term memory, where then it integrates with, okay, I have had experiences today. What does that mean to the experiences I've had before? And let me make sense of it and integrate it, right? And what happens if we don't do this is that you see people, so alcohol doesn't allow us to have REM sleep. Alcohol and a lot of drugs don't let us consolidate our memory. And you'll know, you know, I have friends that have been alcoholics and they just never mature, right? And this is a real problem with addicts. And so, protecting that sleep, avoiding different types of drugs. There's different, like for women in their cycle, when they're in the high estrogen cycles, they have much better REM. But it's common knowledge in the lower estrogen cycles, their REM becomes much less. And so you can imagine if they're not having that memory consolidation, they're going to become more confused about things. It may play a role in why they're having PMS. But if we have a traumatic experience or some thoughts, some thought forms that are bothersome, we're going to perseverate those. We're going to be just going over and over in our mind because we're not maturing it. We're not taking that memory, those thoughts, moving it to our higher brain centers, making sense of it. And this is where you start really getting into the issues with PTSD. And there's a lot of research going on at the regarding the locus coeruleus and this whole aspect that we're talking about right now.
John, let me ask you two questions. One, you talked about pacing the locus coeruleus. And is that a voluntary or involuntary action? Is it something you can control? And then the second question is in regards to, you mentioned alcohol affects REM, but how about late night foods or late night, you know, eating late at night? I mean, does that have an effect as well? I mean, obviously we know it has some sort of an effect, but are you counting that as a more profound effect, maybe up there with medication and alcohol?
Well, REM, anything that's going to affect REM sleep is going to have a negative effect on the memory consolidation.
Okay.
So and then the pacing, the late pacing is going to have an effect on REM, alcohol. I mean, even a small amount of alcohol, you know, my best recommendation for anybody is get something, track your sleep and start to kind of get an idea as to what is affecting your deep sleep, your REM sleep. And, you know, I'm a big fan of, high dose melatonin. I wrote a book on melatonin as well. And we have people dosing melatonin in the hundreds of milligrams, actually, quite safely. If we could, you know, I get a message almost every day regarding some misinformation that's out in the world regarding melatonin. Mm-hmm. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to clear that up right now.
Do it.
Only if you tell me about the pacing, if you could pace the... If you could pace the locus coeruleus, is that, because that was my original part of the question. Can you pace it?
Well, it's through the respiratory system. So
okay.
Breath, right? So as we calm down, we start to breathe slower and slower, right? So it's these receptors in the nasal passage. And that's why the endonasal balloons can be so profound, because you're allowing that connection to, you know, to the rhythm to be more prominent.
Okay. Now melatonin.
So Andrew Huberman, first of all, I want to say, I respect this man immensely. I listened to him. I've learned a lot from him, and he's dead wrong about melatonin. At least this is my understanding from looking at the research.
Love the country.
And there's a lot of, I think there's some supplement companies trying to promote some, sleep supplements that are non-melatonin, and they're trying to discredit melatonin in order to sell. This is what it looks like to me. But the idea that melatonin is anti-gonadal, okay, it's this idea that melatonin can delay puberty or could suppress testosterone is based on one little study that was done on hamsters who are rodents. They're nocturnal, and their sex hormones fluctuate with the mating cycles, which fluctuate with the seasons. And it's not how it works in humans. In fact, studies on humans have proved that this system does not exist. I would love to have a public debate about this if he's interested. But anybody that's interested in melatonin, there's no negative feedback loop. So you can take it exogenously. You can take it as a supplement. You won't shut down your own production, because your production is based on light hitting your eyes. So you're going to build it up in your pineal. But there's also this conversation about all the melatonin at a cellular level, because every cell in your body produces melatonin, every mitochondria. It's part of what keeps the mitochondria from having problems. It's the primary antioxidant that we use. So there's no toxicity to melatonin. In fact, as far as for hormones, there's, you know, hundreds of studies showing that it has a very powerful and positive effect on both male and female hormones.
Pardon my naivety, but well, and I agree with you. And I also think, by the way, the pharmaceutical industry knows how effective melatonin is, and they might be part and parcel in suppressing some of that benefit or disseminating you know, unfortunate information. But back to what I was going to ask you. Do receptor sites, do they get, do you cycle melatonin? Do you take the same dose every day? Is it contingent on the person? I guess it's more contingent on the person. Your point about that? Melatonin.
Yeah. Well, so the question is, do your receptor melatonin receptor sites fatigue? Do you like with a lot of hormones, what happens is when you take the hormone, there's a negative feedback loop. So what happens is the receptors will downregulate, right? This is my understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And this doesn't happen with melatonin, which is really crazy, right? But you know, when you look at melatonin, it's almost like it's not like any other hormone. It is such an incredible molecule that is involved with so many different aspects of health and vitality. And you know, I went through my whole process with and I'm a bit biased based on my experience personally with melatonin, for sure. I will admit that. And I've studied the science probably as much as anybody besides Russell Ryder, who's probably the number one, who I'm in contact with regularly. But I look like I was almost, you know, 60 years old at one point, you know, and I'm 53 now. And I take 200-400 milligrams of melatonin every night.
Are you referring to melatonin over the counter that you get at the nutritional or online, or what? How are you taking it?
So melatonin's according to the research, 2.5% absorbed orally. When we take things orally, you have enzymes in the stomach and first pass through the liver that breaks a lot of these nutrients down. Mm-hmm. And so we have to reconstruct a lot of these molecules after they go through the liver. And so, things like glutathione and melatonin, you know, they don't absorb well orally. So these are some of the things that we manufacture with Mitozen, at mitozen.club. My best advice would be a suppository, but liposomal delivery can also be very beneficial. So our line of melatonin products are called Sandman.
Are these suppositories, are they prescription? I've never even heard of this. Can it be over the counter or just through you? How does that work?
Well, you can find melatonin suppositories online outside of ours. We formulate them with various formulas, like probably our most common Sandman is got 250 milligrams of glutathione and 200 milligrams of melatonin. And I love that combination because glutathione is one of the sleep promoting substances. And I found that a lot of people feel really good. Our stress really depletes our glutathione quite dramatically. And glutathione is helpful for viral immunity. It helps to detoxify us from chemicals and heavy metals, and it helps to calm down inflammation in the body and allergies, sensitivities. So that in combination with melatonin can be quite nice.
Every night or when you think you might need it? Is there a recipe?
Well, I found, for me, I take it virtually every night. I mean, there are some nights that I'll take off, but there are a lot of people I work with, that's not what they want to do. I would say if there's someone dealing with a significant health issue, or they're looking to really do some, serious anti-aging, you know, I would consider taking it most nights. I'll tell you where it really shines is when you're under stress. Like if you're traveling, for instance, right? Mm. Like, I don't know that I would ever travel. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Ben Greenfield or not, but he's kind of a big podcaster. And whenever he has a trip, I mean, he's like blowing our phone up. Like, I'm out of it. I can't, you know, head to London without this stuff. But I agree, you know, because not only not only is it stressful when you're in the plane and you're sleeping in a strange bed, you're trying to figure out where you're going to want to go. What a difference the taking mel- and not just melatonin, but a high dose of melatonin, because not only are you addressing the sleep and maybe the change in time zones, but that he calls it a melatonin sledgehammer, right? There's something that just resets your system and you feel so rested after a night with a higher dose. But, you know, not everybody initially will feel great with higher doses of melatonin. I found that some people will feel kind of sluggish and maybe not feel great for a few nights, because melatonin actually detoxifies the brain of heavy metals, and your body will start doing some house cleaning. And so it's possible that there could be some short-term kind of, we call it Herxheimer, right? So the word Herxheimer means when we have like some negative symptoms based on some detoxification, or maybe our body's immune system kicks up and there's some latent, you know, infections, candida, or some viruses that the body starts to like kill off. And you might have like a headache or fatigue or some digestive complaints. And these can be actually positive things sometimes when you're first starting out with some sort of a program with someone that might actually be really good. Is it initially you'll feel a little bad.
You answered my follow-up concern is that for those who might feel groggy after taking melatonin the next night, it's almost disheartening to it's like, I wanted to, you know, get, you know, wake up energized, ready to go, but you feel groggy. Yeah. And it's not all the time, but it's that you just explained it. Very vital.
Well, another point is also that some people have their slow metabolizers of melatonin, and the same gene pathway that deals with caffeine deals with melatonin. There's a fairly, I think 20-30% of the population has this gene issue. And so that means that if I took melatonin at say 9 o'clock at night, you know, let's say that it's going to take me normally 8 hours to metabolize it, but I have the gene issue and it may be 12 hours. So maybe it's better for me to take my melatonin at like say 6 or 7 that night. And that way, by the time I wake up, I'm not as groggy. And the other trick I would recommend is when you wake up, get some light in your eyes, like go right out and look at the sun.
How do you find out
if you wake up at 3 a.m?
Oh yeah, screw you.
I start my day at 3. It's always dark. If it's light, I get nervous. Maybe take a flashlight.
Well, you can get blue lights. I did a post this morning on my Instagram account, and I have these. There's these lights that you can get. They're about, I'd say, 4 by 6 inches or something like that, right? They're like a panel, and you can change the color of them. And I put them up above my cabinets, so they're kind of like shining up at the ceiling. And I've got them in the corner, and you turn them on, and they're on like blue, like a blue green color. Yeah. In the morning, and then you can switch it to red at night. So you wake up in the morning and you got blue green everywhere, and that's going to help, right? The sun's the best. Yeah. But if you're waking up, I wake up early too. I'm up at 4, sometimes 3:30.
Yeah.
How do you find out if you're one of those? How do you find out if you're one of those slow metabolizers where you, like you just said, where you would have to take it at 6 instead of say at 9? That's just something to experiment you're with?
Well, I usually what I recommend is how do you do with caffeine? You know, like, do you normally like need half the amount of caffeine that the normal person? And also, if you do caffeine, do you find yourself wired for a longer period of time than what normally people are? Usually people know if that's them. And then I would just assume that they have that gene issue.
Love this.
Oh, this is great. All right, let's talk about another chemical besides melatonin, meth blue. So methylene blue. So we know that's a, instead of giving you Smurf pee, you know, we know that it affects the hemoglobin, oxygen transport to the bodies, and it's good for energy production. But can you elaborate on, as a clinician, the effects of Meth Blue?
Well, it's a synthetic salt, right? And it's the only synthetic compound that has ever been discovered that has literally been proven to act on all four of the complexes within the mitochondria. And so, I know you know this stuff, but this is just for the people.
Absolutely. Yeah, please do it.
You've got the mitochondria, right? This is where the energy is being made. And the job of the mitochondria is to move electrons, right? In the process of moving electrons, it makes heat, right? It's called exothermic. That's the chemical name for it. And so it's moving those electrons through these four complexes, and they're named after, you know, one complex 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the fourth complex is called cytochrome C. And cyto is for cell and chrome is for light. And that the reason that it's called cytochrome C is because it can use both photons, which is from light, or electrons, which is from matter. So you have matter and non-matter, which is, you can actually start to get into some interesting spiritual conversations about that. What they found is that the methylene blue upregulates the first, second, and third complex by about 110%. And it improves the fourth complex by about 70%. And what you can do is you can add red light, or you can go out in the sun and you can boost that even further. So methylene blue is considered photodynamic, right? So there's a number of substances that are like this, where you can use light or phototherapy, or they also call it photobiomodulation, and take the substance as well. And you get this really beautiful compounding effect. Now, probably one of the most antimicrobial combinations I think that's possible is combining red light with methylene blue. And in fact, that's what the blood banks do to sterilize blood. So if you've ever gotten a blood transfusion, you've likely gotten a little bit of methylene blue. And what they do is they put some methylene blue in the blood, and then they irradiate it with a red light. And so we actually are doing that here in our clinic, where we're doing an IV of methylene blue, and then we have a laser catheter, so we can literally laser the blood. And this can be really amazing for a number of viral infections, including HIV, herpes, all the herpes family, Epstein-Barr. We worked with the last pandemic, and I've seen within a day, like on their deathbed to like walking out of the clinic, like, "Hey, I'm fine." You know, I mean, just stuff that shouldn't be, right?
That's so cool.
So it really holds a lot of promise, and you don't need to go to a clinic. I mean, methylene blue absorbs fantastic orally. Dosage wise, this is where you might want to write this down, is it's a half a milligram to 4 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. That's kind of like the zone. Most of what you're going to see out in the literature is going to say that you want to be like on a very much lower dose. Most of what I'm seeing is, 20, 30, 40 milligrams. I found clinically and personally that folks generally do a little bit better with more towards the middle of that dosing schedule. But the reason that we have this schedule of half a milligram to 4 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, so like 70 kilograms is about 150 pounds, right? So you're looking at like an average adult male, and you're looking at 70 times a half a kilogram, that's 35 milligrams to 4 times 70 is like about 300, right?
Right.
Is my math about right there?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have this kind of window, and you have to find out what is going to work for you through experimenting it, because nobody can tell you that, right? But you're safe to take it within that window, and you probably can take a lot more, but not on a daily basis. Yeah. And especially if you're on an SSRI, or a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, which, MAO inhibitors basically prevent the breakdown of serotonin. And so what happens is, you can get what's called a serotonin storm, because methylene blue acts as an MAO, I, and, there has been some, issues with people having serotonin storm. 30% of the time that someone goes into a serotonin storm, they will die. So it is a lethal. It's very serious. Those incidences were primarily, there was 5 cases that were getting a thymectomy, and they were being given intravenous methylene blue so that they could visualize the thymus gland, because it's very metabolically sensitive, right? So when they're doing the surgery, the thymus gland was really lighting up. And the patients that were on SSRIs, actually, they died. And it was a big deal. And it's sad. And so then they had this warning that said, no methylene blue in combination with SSRIs or MAO and MAOI inhibitors. But then Mayo Clinic came back, they looked at the data, and they rescinded the warning, and they said only no SSRIs and methylene blue in this procedure, in a thymectomy. And Canada did the same thing, but the FDA still has the warning. So any medical professional, you know, you just need to know that that's the situation that you're dealing with. Francisco Gonzalez Lima, stated in some interviews that he felt that it was a real shame, because methylene blue had a very large clinical trial, 1,500 humans, human trial, for manic depression. And the results were great. Like, it was a very favorable study. And so I've seen methylene blue really, really help depression in a lot of cases in my clinic. And it does, it improves mood, but more so in the higher doses, not the smaller doses. And Dr. Lima was very saddened, because the United States FDA just maintains this warning, and we've got this shadow on methylene blue, and people are literally afraid, terrified of even tiny doses of methylene blue if they're taking SRIs. But this is what I say. Anybody that is a clinician, or maybe you're having depression and you want to look at alternatives from antidepressants, and why you might want to do that is that you want to take care of your blue spot, right? We talked about how serotonin prevents the pausing. And this is why you see commercials with antidepressants. Well, if your current antidepressant isn't working, you might want to stack it with this new one. And it's like these people are stacked with like so many different meds, right? And it's because whether it's like a Wellbutrin that's working on norepinephrine, well, you're like charging up the locus coeruleus already. Like you're ramping it up. Or if you're on one that's more based on a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, you're inhibiting the locus coeruleus from memory consolidation. And so you're going to be perseverating on all of those negative thoughts, right? And it's going to be hard for you to pull yourself out of that. So initially, oftentimes people feel good, and then it kind of wanes, right? And that's because the neurology and the science really doesn't make sense, right? So we need to look at different ways. And the reason that I really like methylene blue is because, and this, I'm going to go out on a limb. This is a kind of an extreme statement that I'm going to be making, but I believe that depression is 90% of the time a result of a chronic infection. And that chronic infection is causing an adaptive response in the body to elevate nitric oxide. And it's the nitric oxide that's directly activating the creating the depression, the depressive state. And there is some mechanisms through the locus coeruleus with that as well. So what they found, and the reason I've come to this conclusion is what they found is that one of the things that methylene blue does is it suppresses nitric oxide. It mops it up. And that's what the scientists believe is the cause of the depression. They've done studies where they took groups of people where they increased their nitric oxide and the depression went up, and they lowered the nitric oxide and the depression went down. So it was directly in proportion to this nitric oxide. And so nitric oxide vasodilates. It's good. We want to, a lot of people take it because they want to go work out. They want to have healthier cardiovascular systems, right? But it's a rhythm, right? Nitric oxide is not supposed to be like something that you have up and high all the time. Like you don't should be taking like arginine like 24/7, right? So take it a couple times a week during your workout. Don't overdo it. So if we're treating the cause of the depression, methylene blue is calming down the infection, therefore lowering the nitric oxide, we're actually treating the cause of the depression. And that's what I like. I want to treat the cause. I don't want to be chasing symptoms, right? So you've got all these psychiatrists and psychologists that are terrified to use methylene blue because they're all on SSRIs, right? Mm-hmm. This is the strategy. So this is how you do it. If you are in the business and you're dealing with people and you're prescribing SSRIs or that's being prescribed to you, the game plan would be this. Preferably run some labs. Look at what your viral titers are. Maybe look at Lyme. Look at some gut markers if you've got some mold. Kind of get some assessment to see if you have some infection in the body, right? And then if you treat that, that's going to be a great thing. But if you start to switch from, first of all, you need to do this with your doctor. I'm not giving you medical advice at all. This is just for education and entertainment purposes, right? But if one was going to start taking methylene blue, they would take a smaller dose and they would be doing it for a short period of time in order to eventually get off of the SSRIs, because we want to be able to pause that locus coeruleus, because we want to start consolidating our memory. This is going to be a healthier brain, a healthier emotional state. So it has to be like an actionable step. It's not, well, hey, I can't take methylene blue and SSRIs. Well, let's look at a transitional plan, right? That's what I would encourage people to look at.
Is there a best time to take methylene blue, or does it depend on what you're taking it for?
You can take it at night. I found a handful of people that the first time or two that they took it, if they took it late, it kept them up. But then once you get used to it, I think anything if gives you a boost initially is going to interrupt your sleep.
Okay. Do you find that the best way to take it is just like orally, or like put it between? I tried it one time. I put it between my cheek and gum. That was a mistake because my entire teeth turned blue and I had to go out and work. So when do you find the best way to take it, and do you take it every day, or do you take it just when you need it, three times a week?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I've gone through some evolutions on how I've been personally taking it and how I've recommended it. Initially, I was having my patient take it every 10 days and then taking 2 or 3 days off. And then I kind of loosened up on that, and I started to understand methylene blue a little bit better, and was looking at longer stretches, right? But still with a couple of days off. Maybe it could be a couple of weeks or even a month. Then I'll take a couple of days off. I'm actually on a break right now. I've not taken it for a couple of days, but I think I might have been taking it for maybe 2 months before that. So a little bit longer. But I've been feeling fine. I think as long as you're within the window and you're not taking excessive hundreds and hundreds of milligrams every day, if you're kind of in the lower spectrum of that half a milligram to say maybe 2 milligrams per kilogram, you're safe to take it every day. For sure, there's been studies like the study with depression. They had people on 300 or 400 milligrams for like a couple of years and there was no problems. Hmm. There's people that there's studies where they were using methylene blue and having people on, for lifetime on, you know, higher doses with no problems, but it could accumulate. And what happens is I felt that where it accumulates a little bit and you start to feel a little bit more lethargic. And I took a day or two off and then I started taking it again. And I felt that really good feeling that I get when I take methylene blue again. So again, it's really unique. It's going to be, I think, different for everybody. But if you start taking methylene blue and then you notice that the effects start to wane a little bit, take a day or two off, start back on and notice, does that seem to work for you? And maybe mark on your calendar when you took it and when you didn't, and start to kind of get a feel for what your rhythm would be.
Okay. So I'm going to tell you right off the top, we have to close. We are absolutely unquestionably having you on for a part two, if you don't mind, because we have a whole host of other questions that we wanted to ask you, but we have run out of time.
We never even got to Ganesh either.
We'll get to Ganesh. In fact, and part two will be called Ganesh.
Yeah, how about that? And I want to tell you that this was fantastic information. I love hearing what you have to say. And if you're in town, you know, give me a call or text me or something like that. We'll get together. But
that means a lot coming from you. You know, you're an amazing doctor in what you've done, and you've inspired me. And so for you to say those words, it means a lot to me. Thank you.
Well, I'm not as big. I'm not as big of a man as him. But if you're ever, when you're in the Southern California area, especially in your vents, you give me a call, and I'd love to hang out with you too.
And Terry, you as well, my friend.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, you're doing such good work, right? I'm backpedaling now, right?
No. We're all good. But
now he can reach his REM sleep tonight.
Yeah, right, that's feel very better. Nice. Hey, we're so proud of you and for what you've done for our profession and getting us out of the realm of backcrackers. Yeah. We're so proud of the work you've done, and we would love to continue this conversation on a part two, because I think the words you have can help so many people, and that's what it's all about. The more we can help people and get people to think beyond their little box, I think is what it's all about. So we really love you and appreciate you, man.
Well, you know, I am such a fan of natural healing, and you know, the power that built the body is the power that can heal the body. Yeah, and that innate intelligence and that universal intelligence flowing through the body gets blocked sometimes. And it's not always a subluxation in the spine. You know, sometimes it's a subluxation in the cranium, or sometimes it's a subluxation in the mitochondria, right? A mitochondrial subluxation.
There you go.
Or a Lucas Aurelius subluxation.
All right, man. You have a blessed day.
That was great.
I'll reach out to you and we'll book part two. So thanks, man. Appreciate your time.
Please.
All right, buddy. Love.
You bet. Same.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Cracking Backs podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at Cracking Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.